Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Heather Carleton.
Good afternoon. This is Aya Trees from CDC Boston Central Lab. First of all, I would like to welcome everybody to this call. This is the first of a series of seminars we have planned to give this year surrounding the topic of whole genome sequencing. A couple of weeks ago, many of you probably participated in the 50-state call on the Listeria Whole Genome Sequencing Project. We figured that since these calls are going to be continuing this year, we figured that you will probably get a whole lot more out from these calls if you have at least a basic understanding about the data analysis and data interpretation. So this afternoon, our first seminar will tackle that topic. Dr. Heather Carleton, who is a postdoc fellow working in my lab, is going to give you this presentation. Very often with whole genome sequencing, you hear the concepts wet lab and dry lab. Wet lab referring to the procedure that generates the raw sequence reads, and then dry lab referring to the analysis procedure after the reads come off from the sequencer. So Heather over here is my damp or slightly moist person. She is mainly a laboratorian, but she also has pretty good basic understanding of bioinformatics. So with further ado, I would like to give the floor, or I should probably say air, to Heather. Heather.
All right, thank you, Aya, and once again, thank you all for joining the call today. So what I'm going to be discussing is very basic terms that surround a lot of what you hear about for whole genome sequence data and next-generation sequencing, and also to discuss some of the analyses you can do with the whole genome sequence data. And I'm targeting my talk to be about 40 minutes so that we can open up to questions afterwards. So as I talk, please write down any questions you have about my slides, and then we can discuss more after my talk ends. All right. So today we're going to provide a basic overview of the terminology surrounding whole genome sequence data and explain ways to analyze WGS data to characterize isolates. So the first term that you'll probably hear in reference to next-generation sequencing data is a raw read. So a raw read is a single sequence output from your next-generation sequencing machine. And the length of your raw read often depends on the chemistry you're using. And you'll hear things like 150 base pair chemistry or 250 base pair chemistry. And that's just in reference to the wet lab side, what chemistry you're using to sequence. Generally, for one bacterial isolate, you would have 100,000 to millions of raw reads that are generated for that one isolate using next-generation sequencing. And as you can see in the graph below, this is called a pileup, where you're piling up all your raw reads, in this case to a reference. And at any particular location, you can see here there's tens to hundreds of raw reads. So another term that surrounds the next-generation sequencing data is quality scores. So quality scores is the likelihood that the base call that is made by your sequencer is correct. And the term that's used for this is the FRED score, part of your FASTQ file that you'll get off your next generation sequencer. So each base pair that your machine calls has a quality score attached to it. And normally people look at Q30 as a measure of how good your sequencing is. So Q30 is the percentage of base calls that have a 1 in 1,000 chance of being incorrect. So out of a 1,000 base pair read, if you do that type of sequencing chemistry, you would have a chance of one base pair being called incorrectly if you're looking at Q30. And so I've drawn a graph here where you look at the Q score and look at all the raw reads in this diagram that are Q30 or better. And so here we have 95% of our reads are Q30 or better. So 95% of our raw reads have a 1 in 1,000 chance or less of being called incorrectly. Another term you may hear too is Q20, which is a 1 in 100 chance of having an incorrect base call. And it really just indicates how much usable data you have from a run. So another term you'll hear is coverage, and there's two different ways to look at coverage. It could be the average or general coverage of your raw reads over your genome of interest, and that can be determined just by determining the total number of base pairs you've sequenced and divide that by your genome size. So in this example here, we've had 156 million base pairs sequenced. Our genome size is 3 million, so we end up with a 52x coverage. But some areas of your bacterial genome will sequence better than others. So even though you may have, as we look at the graph below, this is another example of a pileup where you have the lines representing raw reads, and at the bottom line, this is your reference genome. So here your average genome coverage is 41, but when you look at a specific point like this red line here, there's only 7 reads that cross this line, so at this specific point, the coverage is 7x. And this comes into play downstream as you're doing analysis. And another whole genome sequence term is de novo assembly, and this is what a lot of people do with their raw reads is they want to go on and assemble the genome of whatever they sequenced. So generally to do de novo assembly, you start out with a raw read, and then you'll want to trim that raw read, removing base pairs with bad quality scores, or those bad spread scores that I mentioned earlier. And there's other considerations when trimming the raw reads, but generally you do it based on quality score. After you've trimmed your raw reads, you map them to see where they overlap. And once you find where they overlap, you're going to combine them into a single contig. So a contig is the assembly of overlapping reads into a single longer piece of DNA. Another way to do assembly is reference-guided assembly, where you map your raw reads to a closely related reference genome. And once again, you map your raw reads to your reference genome, and you can extract contigs. And you can determine, based on quality and coverage thresholds, how you want to extract your contigs. Here, I only extracted 2. Because in this middle section right here, there isn't as much coverage. So that might be something I would consider not meeting my quality and coverage threshold. So it wouldn't be part of my contig assembly. And there's advantages and disadvantages of doing both de novo versus reference-guided assembly. De novo assembly can be computationally costly. That just means it might take a while to run on your computer, depending on how fast your computer is at analysis. It's difficult if there are repeat regions, and this is particularly a consideration for E. coli genomes. And an advantage of it is it assembles everything that can be assembled into contigs will be assembled into contigs. So that includes both the genome and any associated plasmids. For reference-guided assembly, it requires a closely related good reference genome. As you can imagine, if you're mapping these raw reads to a non-closely related reference genome, there's a lot of a lot of reads from your isolate of interest that might not map to your reference just because it's not that closely related. Maybe it has different genes or other associated genome elements that might not be found in your core reference genome. And once again, it only assembles reads that are a match to the reference. So it doesn't assemble plasmids or other elements in the genome if there's no reference for them. So a way to assess whether or not you have a quality assembly is to look at the number of contigs your raw reads assemble into. And just a general rule of thumb for us for good assemblies is E. coli would be less than 200 contigs, Salmonella less than 100, and Listeria less than 30 contigs. For another way to look at whether or not your assemblies are good is the N50 statistic. And it's calculated by summarizing the lengths of the biggest contig until you reach the 50% of the total combined contig length. So what I mean by this is diagrammed out in the map below. So here I've lined up all the contigs by their length. I'm starting at largest and going to smallest on the right. I'm looking at a 3 million base pair genome that I've determined by looking at the sum of all the contig lengths. So I know that my N50 cutoff should be 1.5 million base pairs. So if I start on the left-hand side and start scanning to the right to see where that N50 cutoff hits, it will hit in the middle of this third contig, which is 350,000 base pairs. So that would be your N50, is 350,000 base pairs. And in general, a good N50 is 200,000 base pairs for most genomes. So there are various ways to analyze this whole genome sequence data, and today I'm going to be talking about primarily the ways that we analyze the data in the Listeria real-time sequencing project. And these three ways are looking at k-mer analysis, whole genome multi-locus sequence typing, and the high-quality single nucleotide polymorphism, or HQ-SNP analysis. And on the right-hand side, I've diagrammed out part of the reason that we have this stepwise approach to how we do these analyses, and they have different computational demands. So whereas k-mer analysis is not very computationally costly, HQ-SNP analysis is, which means we have to deploy them in different ways if we want to have a real-time analysis. So in k-mer analysis, you use a computer algorithm that has a sliding window to chop up your raw reads into a shorter length, k, of DNA. And K is determined by which length gives you the best specificity and most adequate resolution. So comparing similar and unique k-mers will give you a measure of relatedness. And on the diagram I have in the second half of the slide, I'm showing you a raw read of 15 base pairs. And then below that, I show the sliding window of making the k-mers. So my k-mer length is 10 base pairs in this example. And the computer algorithm will go across that raw read and chop it up into 10 base pair, and only 10 base pair pieces. And when you're comparing raw reads between isolates, you're looking for the k-mers that are identical, which is the first four, comparing isolate 1 and isolate 2. And you'll also identify unique k-mers, so this one has a single base pair difference, as a way to say how related or how different your two isolates are. So a lot of times when we do these analyses, the output for the data is a phylogenetic tree. And right now I'm going to go over a little bit of how to understand what the phylogenetic tree is telling you. So on this particular tree, branch length indicates relatedness, and branch length is indicated here above the horizontal line. The vertical line links don't indicate relatedness. They're just to show how where the isolates connect. So shorter horizontal branch lengths indicate the highly related isolates, and longer branch lengths indicate less related. And for examples here, looking at this red node or node 1, isolate A and B have short horizontal branch lengths between each other, indicating that they are highly related. Or when you look at node 3, the branch lengths between isolate E and isolate D, the branch length for isolate C is very long, which indicates isolate D and isolate E are less related to each other. And this branch length is affected by the relatedness of the two genomes as well as the number of isolates that you're comparing in the entire tree. And when branch lengths join at a node, this node indicates a common ancestor. And for example, here in this blue node 2, it indicates a common ancestor of those isolates I previously discussed of A, B, C, D, and E. And also, these nodes could indicate a common transmission source as well. So when you look at a CAMR tree, and this is a tree that was presented during the 50 state call we had recently, you can look, so the first part of the tree here is the Crave Brothers outbreak isolates. And the second part of the tree, the yellow isolates, are new clinical isolates that were sequenced after the outbreak was closed. And you might notice that there's a branch separating the Crave Brothers and the newer clinical isolates. In that most of these isolates fall under two different nodes, which indicate that these isolates may have two different transmission sources. And indeed, the epi information does support that there's a different transmission source here than there is for the Crave Brothers outbreak. But as you can imagine, as we go further in the Listeria project and we start sequencing more and more isolates, it's very hard to look at a CAMR tree, which I'm showing here, of more than 600 isolates and say what is a cluster or not. So we also use other measures to identify clusters and how related isolates are. So an advantage of doing CAMR analysis is it does not require a reference or multiple sequence alignment. It's a relatively fast analysis, and it does not require assembly. The disadvantages are that CAMR analysis does not provide information about where in the genome the differences are between two isolates, because you're chopping up these raw reads into the CAMRs. You have no reference of where those raw reads came from. And it does not consider sequence quality, and I put a star by that because the CAMR analysis itself may not consider sequence quality, but you could trim your raw reads before you analyze them, and that's a way to filter out poor quality raw reads. Additionally, it does not provide a true phylogenetic relationship or tree, but it is very proximal to a true phylogenetic relationship, and it doesn't lead to a strain type nomenclature. Next, we're going to talk about single nucleotide polymorphism or variant analysis. So in the graphic below the SNP outline, the single nucleotide polymorphism is a difference in a single nucleotide when you're comparing it to a reference genome. And so here in our sequence, we have a C at this position, and in the reference genome, it's a G. So that would be a SNP. And these are phylogenetically informative differences. Another term you might hear when talking about SNP analysis is insertions or deletions, which are referred to as indels. And here I have a graphic of a delete or an insertion. So in the reference genome, there is no base pair there, and in your comparative sequence, there is a C. So we do not use these differences for HQ SNP analysis, and a lot of times they can be a product of errors in sequencing, particularly in next-generation sequencing. All right, so there are different ways to perform SNP analysis. We do reference-based SNP calling and look for high-quality SNPs. And to do this, we map the raw reads onto a highly related reference genome. And we call whether or not a difference is a SNP based on coverage and read frequency at that SNP location. And this shows us a phylogenetic relationship. So in the graphic below, I've mapped raw reads to reference genomes. In this example here, I have 10 raw reads, and you might notice that only 80% of them agree for the SNP change. So depending on how I set my thresholds for calling a SNP, that may or may not be considered a SNP. In the Listeria project, we consider 10x coverage and 75% frequency. So for the Listeria project, this would be considered a SNP. When looking to the right side at the raw reads mapped to the reference genome, although they all agree for the base pair difference, they all are C, it's only 3x coverage here. You only have 3 raw reads that map to this reference genome. So you would not call this a SNP because it doesn't meet your coverage threshold. And also when calling SNPs, there's a consideration of where do you want to call a SNP. So you can focus on different parts of the genome and it will give you different SNP counts. And what I mean by this is you could look at the entire genome, or you could choose to only look at SNPs that are found in genes or coding regions and not consider SNPs that are outside of coding regions. You can look at only core genes, which would be the genes that are shared between all the isolates you're comparing. Or you can even mask part of the genome and not consider any of the SNPs found here. And in this example below, I'm masking a mobile element, so I'm not considering the SNPs called in this location. And I'm only looking at SNPs called in green, which are the green mask to the right. So an important consideration is different SNP calling pipelines and different ways you call the SNP or where you decide to call the SNP will give you different SNP counts based on these considerations. So occasionally you'll see that you might do analysis on your own and end up with a different SNP count than we might do here at the CDC. And often the reason for that is different pipeline and different considerations of where to call the SNPs in the genome. So here we're looking at a tree that is an HQ SNP tree, and to the right is the median number of HQ SNPs, and we're also breaking it out in different colors by nodes. This was also presented in the 50-state call for the Listeria project. And you can see here that some of these isolates in red are highly related. There's 9.5 median SNPs. And as you further out on these branches, the SNP number increases, and the question is, how related are these isolates, or how close is close to be considered part of the outbreak? And another point is, although we might have food matches that are closely related to our main cluster of isolates, and so here in the brown circle is an isolate sequence from kale. Looking at these clinical cases, there was no exposure. None of the clinical cases have had exposure to kale. So even though we might have closely related isolates, food isolates or potential source isolates by whole genome sequencing, does not mean it is the source for the outbreak, and epidemiological information is still very important to be able to link back the exposures, the relevant exposures to the clinical cases. So advantages of doing HQ SNP analysis is it's phylogenetically informative. And the SNP positions can be identified on the genome to determine what gene or intergenic region contains the SNP. So you can go back and look at where you found the SNP and find out, well, was this in a particular gene that might be associated with antibiotic resistance or with housekeeping genes. And you have that capability here, which you don't have in the KMER-based analysis. A disadvantage is that it requires a closed reference genome or good draft genome. And unfortunately, recently closed reference genomes from all serotypes are not available. And this is particularly true in pathogens like Salmonella, where we don't have closed reference genomes in all the different serotypes we study as part of FullSTEM. And it's also computationally costly. It requires a multiple singlets alignment to a reference. And when you're looking at tens to hundreds of genome or tens to hundreds of isolates, this can take a long time. And it also doesn't lead to a strain type nomenclature. So another analysis that we perform as part of the Listeria real-time sequencing project is doing whole genome MLST. And here we compare gene content between different isolates. And this, in the case of Listeria, that's over 3,000 genes. And one or more differences in a particular gene or locus equals a new allele name. And you can categorize genes into subgroups as well that are informative subgroups such as virulence profiles, serotypes, antimicrobial resistance determinants, your traditional housekeeping gene, MLST. You could also look at the ribosomal gene, MLST, and the core genome. All of that is contained within your whole genome MLST. And you can use software such as BigsDB or Bionumeric 7.5 that can run these analyses. And in the lower part of this slide, I have a graphic explaining what, for a particular locus 1, you'll have different allele calls based on one or more SNP differences or even a deletion and a SNP change as well compared to allele 1. But that will just be boiled down into a new allele name, those differences. So on this slide, I'm showing a whole genome MLST tree that we generated in Bionumerics. On the left-hand side here, this is the percent differences or how highly related the genomes are. And as you can see here, our scale is 97% to 100%. So all of these isolates I'm showing on this slide are highly related. And this tree is made out of isolates from the Crave Brothers outbreak, as well as that other cluster I was telling you about, the 1312 MLDX6-1. And you can see here that WG-MLST performs equivalent to the KMER-based analysis or HQ-SNPs, and it also separates out those two clusters, which happen to be the same PFTE type. In the middle, I'm showing what the different allele calls look like. So I'm not showing it here, but there are over 3,000 allele calls for these isolates. And for each allele, you will have a number indicating what allele it is and whether it's different or not from other isolates in that database. So the advantages of doing whole genome MLST analysis is that it's phylogenetically informative, and all subtyping genes, virulence genes, and antibiotic resistance genes can be pulled out of your database as part of the analysis. So you can actually create a standardized nomenclature based on these allele calls. And this is different than what you have with the KMER-based analysis or the HQ-SNP analysis, which really doesn't lend itself to doing a standardized nomenclature. Disadvantages is it's computationally costly, at least initially, to assign alleles. But once the alleles are assigned, you only keep that character data. It's not costly to perform analyses after you've already named your alleles. And you're also comparing character data and not genetic data like SNP or indel differences. They're treated equally, and this is an advantage or a disadvantage. So it's a disadvantage because you're losing some of that rich genetic information, but it also boils down differences that you might find in genetic hotspots, which might make isolates seem more different than they actually are. And as I mentioned, there's no difference between one or more SNP or indel differences in naming an allele. So overall, for whole genome sequencing, there's a lot of opportunities. So it can serve as a universal high-resolution subtyping method, and all information currently obtained by traditional methods are contained within the sequence data. So you can do things like pull out genes involved in the serotype, virulence, resistance, et cetera. And you have a huge savings opportunity by replacing traditional methods with next-generation sequence data once those methods get validated. Challenges are you're generating a large amount of data, and this presents issues with data storage and analysis, as I mentioned. Another issue is there's currently no standardization for quality metrics or analysis pipelines. So looking at the same sequence data, two different people at two different institutions could analyze it differently and come out with a different answer of how many SNP differences there are and how related or unrelated isolates are just based on their different analysis pipelines. Additionally, the backwards comparability of a whole genome sequence data with PFG is difficult to establish because PFG doesn't give you a phylogenetic relationship like whole genome sequencing data does, and it's just very different data. Another challenge we're currently facing, particularly with the Listeria project, is interpretation of data. So how to define clusters, since we're looking at a continuous data spectrum rather than very categorical, so one band difference versus, you know, tens to hundreds of SNP differences between isolates. So that's the conclusion of my seminar. I want to quickly jump to the last slide. And we will make these slides available at the end of the call. It's just a list of potential tools you can use to do whole genome sequence analysis if you'd like to get started. And I'd like to remind everybody that our next seminar will be Friday, covering the same topic that I did today. And next month, we'll be discussing different next-generation sequencing platforms. So thank you very much for joining the call, and I think next we're going to go to questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please record your first and last name when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. And any time if you'd like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment for our first question. Our first question comes from Heather. Your line is now open.
Yes, I have a question about harmonizing methods or metrics for analysis. Is CDC leading an effort, or maybe FDA looking at efforts to do that, to harmonize analysis of whole genome sequences?
This is Aya from CDC. I can answer this question. There is actually an international effort going on trying to harmonize both the sequence quality metrics and the analysis pipeline. That is called the GMI, the Global Microbial Identifier Movement. There's a website for that. If you just Google Global Microbial Identifier, you can find a lot of information. There are actually five different work
work groups that you can sign up to be part of the movement, and there's a annual meeting. This year the meeting will be in September, the second week of September in York, UK. So we are, and both FDA, USDA, and CDC are active participants in this movement. So we are trying to do this in international scale, not just on national scale, because we envision exchange of data at international level, given that the foodborne outbreaks do not know borders.
Thank you. At this time, we have no further questions in queue. Again, we have no further questions in queue.
Any more questions?
No, ma'am. There are no further questions in queue.
Okay. If there are no further questions, you can, if you can think up something later on, you can always email us.
One moment, ma'am. We did have one question come
Excellent.
In. That question is from Jen. Jen, your line is now open.
Thank you. I was wondering whether the harmonization or lack thereof, how that will affect our ability to work with local partners who may be able to do whole genome sequencing for our outbreaks versus sending isolates to CDC, and if you could talk to that subject a little bit. Thank you.
You brought up a good point. We've already noticed that the lack of harmonization when it comes to analysis methods will definitely cause different interpretation of data. As an example, I can mention a Salmonella enteritidis outbreak that was in a nursing home in New York, and the Westford Center, in collaboration with an academic institution, analyzed those isolates from there and came up with a reasonable amount of SNPs within the outbreak-associated isolates. However, when we analyzed, not the same data, but data from different enteritidis outbreaks, we had huge SNP variations among outbreak-related isolates. And then we started talking with New York, and it turned out that we were calling the SNPs looking at the whole genome, whereas their analysis method was masking all the variable elements such as VNTRs or mobile elements such as transposons. And that difference made the difference in the number of SNPs. So if you're comparing two different analysis methods, you really need to get down to the weeds what comes to the exact analysis method. So which parts of genome are you looking at? The whole genome versus core genes? For example, I'm pretty sure that when FDA calls high-quality SNPs, they only call those from core genes, so genes present in all isolates of that particular Salmonella serotype, for example. Whereas we at CDC, we look at the whole genome, intergenic regions and the genes, and also variable genes, because there are some genes that are not present in all isolates of the same serotype, so mobile genes. We look at those too. So those can definitely increase or decrease the number of SNPs. So right now, the only way you can really compare the data and the two analyses is to make sure that the analysis is done the same way. In the future, the reason why we are so attracted to the whole genome MLSD method is that would largely standardize the analysis method. If everybody would use that method to look at the data, that would largely take care of the standardization. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, sort of. So if we are going to work with a local partner, we would want to make sure they're using the whole genome MLSD, and understand what parts of the genome they're going to be looking at. Anything else? Or also, you know, would we be able to consult with you and be able to cross-check methods, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. We are happy to help any way we can. And not also standardization of the analysis method, but also making sure that your quality metrics for the sequence are the same. So how do you trim your sequences before you assemble the sequences? What minimum coverage you use to call the SNPs? There are huge differences over there, too. So just try to standardize all those aspects.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cindy Wu. Your line is open.
Hi. I was just wondering if you're using commercial software to generate these different trees, or are you using like a specific programming language?
I flipped the slide to the list of the different resources, and we use both commercially available software and software that's freely available, but requires you to have some programming knowledge in Linux. So that's listed here. I tend to use the BioNumerics as well as the CLC Biogenomics Workbench within our branch, and particularly for the Listeria project, we use the SNP extraction tool that's listed on the bottom of this list here.
Thank you. We do have another question in queue.
Did that answer your question first?
So the last one, the SNP extraction tool, is that freely available from GitHub?
Yep, it's freely available from GitHub, and it was created by one of our members in our branch, Lee Katz, in collaboration with others, and you can go to the website listed here to download it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the last person who queued in. I do apologize. I could not understand the pronunciation of your name. So if you queued in, your line is now open.
Hello. Can you hear me? My name is Ivo Van Waller from ECDC in Stockholm. My question was around the quality of the sequences, because I can imagine that will change over time, improve probably. If we have people, let's say, in our network starting with whole genome sequencing, it would be a pity that they start at a moment where later on they will not be able to use those sequences from the past then anymore for the current analysis method. So do you have an idea when we would reach some sort of minimum threshold where we will be able to use whole genome sequencing, let's say, routinely? Onwards.
Hi, Eva. That's a loaded question. I think we are getting closer to that point that where we can actually establish standardized quality metrics. Unfortunately, I do feel that they may vary between different organisms. For example, for calling high-quality SNPs, for Listeria, we've established that 10x coverage is enough. We feel that for Salmonella and E. coli, that may not be enough. Right now, we use 20x coverage, but we still have to run some experiments really seeing how the level of coverage, for example, will affect your SNP calls. So hopefully, within a next few months to a year, we can actually at least come to the ballpark. I'm hoping to be able to say something about this at the GMI meeting in York, in UK.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. At this time, we have no additional questions in queue.
And going off of what AS said about looking at coverage for the whole genome MLST database, currently we're looking at 3x coverage or more for genes to call the alleles, and we're going to be looking at whether we need to go even higher with that coverage to get high-quality allele calls.
Okay, if there are no additional questions, I want to thank you once again, all the participants, for participating in this seminar. And like Heather mentioned earlier, we will have next month a more wet lab-focused seminar where we will go over the basics of the different platforms, particularly the tabletop platforms that are available and are feasible platforms for state public health labs. We are also hoping to be able to discuss the findings of the head-to-head comparison we have performed over here between MySeq and the ion torrent BGM platforms, and talk about a little bit about the comparability of the data and possible recommendations we may have. There will also later on be a more advanced data analysis, data interpretation seminar focusing more on evolutionary phylogenetics. So stay tuned for those seminar announcements. We have not set dates yet. The lab seminar will probably be towards the end of April, and then the more advanced phylogenetics seminar will be maybe May, June or so. So the announcements will go out through APHL. And with that, I would like to thank you, everybody, and we talk to you soon again.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference call. All participants may disconnect at this time.